One of my outstanding senior residents, we'll call her Sammy because I like androgynous names, was recently telling me about a case she had of a young guy with horrible asthma that wasn't responding to usual therapies and was tiring out. So she told me they intubated him for airway protection, to which I replied, "What was wrong with his airway?" She gave me a confused look and said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you just told me you intubated this guy for airway protection, but the problem was asthma, so I don't understand why his airway needed protecting. Did he develop epiglottitis during his asthma exacerbation, or accidentally inhale a hot dog? While he was getting treated, did someone stab him in the neck?" My particularly obnoxious variant of the Socratic method seemed to be working, and she nodded her head. "No, his airway was fine," she said, "but we needed to protect his airway because he was tiring out." Okay, maybe she doesn't get it quite yet. "Sammy, if his airway was fine, why did you need to protect it?" Then it clicked, and she said, "Oh, I see. We didn't need to protect his airway. We needed to intubate him for another reason. But then why do we always say we intubate for airway protection?" Exactly.
He's got concerns and sometimes criticisms, or maybe there is something that the other guys are missing. Whether it's a problem or just consternationism, it's time to get the facts from Ruben Strayerisms.
Why do we always say we intubate for airway protection? Most of the time, we don't mean we're intubating for airway protection, we just mean to say we're intubating. And being sloppy with the terms comes from, and leads to, being sloppy with the concepts. And we can't be sloppy with this concept.
Why parse words like this? What's wrong with saying we're intubating for airway protection as a general concept? Well, the principal reason is that the indication for intubation can predict what difficulties you might run into and defines your intubation strategy.
Also, the airway is a mysterious concept to learners, and airway protection is a mysterious concept for everyone. If you think you understand what airway protection means, try asking 5 emergency providers how you can tell when a patient is protecting their airway, or how you can tell when a patient isn't protecting their airway, and get ready to be confused. It doesn't help folks understand what the airway is and what airway protection is when we say every patient we intubate for airway protection.
In Strayerville, New York, that's the fictional town where you'll find Reuben Regional Medical Center, which, as it turns out, houses an emergency department where people correctly state their intubation indication.
Ah, welcome to Reuben's Regional Medical Center, or specifically, welcome to the lobby of Reuben's Regional Medical Center, because after we determine what department you go to, that individual department will welcome you individually.
There are 6 reasons to intubate. Reasons A through F.
A.
A is for airway, but in this schema, the A for airway is not about airway protection, it's about airway obstruction, and the difference is monumentally important. When you intubate not for airway protection but for airway obstruction, you need to get ready for a rough ride, because there is a good chance that the airway obstruction that indicates intubation is going to make intubation difficult or even impossible. I'm talking about mouth and neck infections like epiglottitis or Ludwig's angina, ENT tumors, foreign bodies, and bleeding into the airway. Bleeding into the airway is a particularly diabolical airway lesion, because the blood that is choking your patient is also going to choke your video laryngoscope, your flexible endoscope, and your line of sight if you do traditional direct laryngoscopy. So be ready. Dynamic airway obstructions deserve special mention. A dynamic airway has the potential to rapidly evolve so that an easy intubation now might be impossible in 5 minutes. Neck trauma, anaphylaxis angioedema, and thermal airway injuries, bullets, bites, and burns. When a patient with one of these problems demonstrates airway signs, move quickly.
As a review from a previous Strayerisms, the airway signs are stridor, voice change, mishandling of secretions, and airway posturing.
So those are the airway reasons to intubate. A for airway.
B.
Next is B for breathing. Breathing concerns are probably the most common reason we intubate in the emergency department. These are lesions that cause failure of oxygenation or ventilation. Asthma, COPD, pneumonia, pulmonary edema, pulmonary fibrosis, and the like. Most of these patients will have normal airways, so compared to the first group, they should be much easier to intubate. The problem with the B for breathing group is that they may have a high oxygenation deficit and drop their sats like a rock as soon as you push drugs, or a high ventilation deficit and drop their pH like a rock as soon as you push drugs. So you need to take specific measures to address this, preferably before you push drugs. And if you use a paralytic, you may need to go fast. Fortunately, the majority of patients who used to be intubated for a breathing problem can be temporized or stabilized by non-invasive ventilation, CPAP or BiPAP.
C.
C is for circulation. Now, intubation is often an insult to the circulation of sick patients because of the sympatholysis you affect with your induction agent and the preload reduction you get with transition to positive pressure. But there are some patients who require intubation to unload the muscles of respiration because they are at the end of their metabolic rope. They're too sick to breathe on their own. This applies most commonly in severe sepsis. Remember in these patients to resuscitate before you intubate and use strategies to minimize the impact of sympatholysis and the transition to positive pressure, like reducing the dose of the induction agent or using a non-paralyzed breathing intubation technique and small tidal volumes.
Let's take a pause because this is coming really fast and furious. A, airways closing, in danger of closing or closed. B, a problem with breathing, a failure of oxygenation and or ventilation. Straightforward so far. C, circulation. This one really confused me as a trainee and, well, kind of as an attending as well. Let's keep it real. The A and the B make sense, but why intubate for circulatory collapse? What's that got to do with breathing? Sure, these patients look sick, but why are we really intubating them? Rubin's phrasing, which is really the most straightforward explanation I've heard, we intubate in this situation to unload the muscles of respiration because these patients are at the end of their metabolic rope. They're too sick to breathe on their own or to breathe on their own much longer. Severe sepsis, massive hemorrhage.
D. Just like always, D stands for neurologic disability. Patients with neurologic catastrophes like intracranial hemorrhage or status epilepticus and patients with CNS depression from overdose, these are the patients who need to be intubated for airway protection. These are the patients who cannot protect their airway and are at risk for aspiration. Though they cannot protect their airway, these patients generally have normal airways, normal lungs, normal hearts. So the focus of preparation and execution should be on brain protection by reducing the impact of the procedure on hemodynamics and intracranial pressure. A much less common subset of D for disability patients who need to be intubated are neuromuscular weakness patients with myasthenia gravis or Guillain-Barré or some other awful neurologic disease who have such profound weakness that they can't gag or cough or are too weak to breathe, which overlaps with the B for breathing patients. Remember that the gag reflex is not an acceptable indicator of airway protection. A significant proportion of lucky people have an absent gag reflex at their baseline, and the presence of a gag reflex does not demonstrate adequate airway reflexes. Furthermore, it's hard to justify performing a maneuver known to precipitate vomiting in patients where you're concerned about their ability to protect their airway. So do not use gag reflex to assess airway protection. Evaluate the ability to handle secretions. And be particularly concerned in obtunded patients who are vomiting. They really do need to be intubated for airway protection.
E
stands for expected course. These are the patients you are concerned are going to develop an ABCD reason to intubate at a time when it's less safe to intubate, like in the CT scanner or in transit to another institution. These patients often present the most challenging decision of whether or not to intubate because you're trying to predict the future. You can use the preferred error strategy to help you.
Ruben's got a whole write-up on this preferred error concept on his website, EM Updates. I'd actually never heard of it before, but here's the crux of it. The preferred error considers how much harm you'll do if you're wrong. But you also have to think about how likely are you to be wrong. In this situation, looking at if you're not sure whether or not to intubate, look from the future backwards. If you intubate a patient who doesn't need to be intubated, how much harm have you done? Some harm. There's a slight chance that you'll fail to intubate, cause harm by trying. Unlikely. Now consider what if you don't intubate, but it turns out the patient needed to be intubated. How much harm is done? Potentially a lot of harm in a patient who's later going to require a crash intubation, which is much more dangerous.
When you look at it this way, you can see that most of the time when you're not sure whether or not to intubate, intubate. This is in contrast to most of the rest of medicine, where most of the time, if you're not sure whether or not to do anything, do nothing.
F.
The last group of patients are the F patients, and F can stand for a few different things here, but I chose F for feral or wild. These are the patients who need to be intubated because they are so agitated that the best way to manage the threat they pose to themselves or others is induction and intubation. This indication has become less relevant now that we're comfortable using dissociative dose ketamine as a tranquilizer, which will quickly bring your feral patient to a state of peaceful unconsciousness while he continues to breathe. But there is definitely a role for adding the paralytic or not and moving forward and intubating these patients, especially if you're concerned not only about agitation, but a dangerous medical condition. This situation comes up all the time in trauma, and we happily intubate seriously injured patients whose agitation prevents us from caring for them, but we may fail to consider this strategy in other very sick patients who are agitated. If your patient whom you've decided needs to be intubated is too agitated to cooperate with proper preparation, like breathing through an oxygen mask or placing an intravenous line, delayed sequence intubation is the right approach, where you dissociate with ketamine, get everything ready, and then paralyze, or not, and intubate. So let's clean up our terminology when it comes to intubation. Most of the patients we intubate, we are not intubating for airway protection, so let's stop saying we're intubating them for airway protection. Know your indications for intubation and the management priorities unique to each indication. Airway obstruction, breathing or respiratory failure, circulation, neurologic disability, expected course, and ferocious, flaming, frickin' feral patients whose serum levels of ketamine are subtherapeutic.
He's got concerns with forming frowsy phrases to intubate ferocious, freaking feral patients. You've got a fructifier fundamental formulations. Ruben is so fly with his Ruben Stray-erations.